Right, well, good afternoon. My name's Ben. Nice to see you all. We've been going through Mark recently, and it's taken us to where we are today, which is chapter 14, verse 27 to 72. And it's a fairly long passage, so we'll take it in sections as we go, and I'll just pray before we read our first section. Father God, thank you for the Bible and thank you that we can meet in person to learn from it. Please help us to understand what we read this afternoon and to be changed by you as a result of what we read. Amen. Great. So let's just do a bit of a recap of what we've done so far more recently in Mark before we start. So Jesus has been traveling around with his disciples. He's been teaching as he goes. He's healed the sick, fed 5,000 with just a little bit more than a packed lunch. He's calmed a violent storm. He's even raised the dead. And then he started predicting his own death. First time he predicted his own death was chapter 8, then again chapter 9 and chapter 10. In fact, 10 verse 33, we read Jesus say, "We're on the way to Jerusalem, where my trial and death will happen." And then last week, if you remember, Johnny talked us through the Last Supper. And there, Jesus told the disciples that one of them would betray him in chapter 14. And they all were left saying, "Surely not me." And our passage this morning continues in a similar way. So we'll look at that first section, which is Mark chapter 14, verse 27 to 31, first of all. And it's just a section that I'm calling Jesus' prediction. So that's the first point if you're taking any notes. So I'll read chapter 14, verse 27 to 31. "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I've risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." "Truly I tell you," Jesus answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the cock crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter insisted emphatically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all the others said the same. So like I say, this week we start in a bit of a similar way to how we ended last week. Only this week, Jesus says, not just one of you will betray me, but Jesus says, all of you are going to betray me. You'll all fall away in verse 27. He quotes from Zechariah, where he says, "I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." And that sentence I've just read there, that would be like a headline for our passage today. "I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." Because as we think about this passage up to verse 72, we'll see exactly those two things happening. We'll see a mixture of the shepherd, which is Jesus, being struck, and also the sheep, as in the disciples, being scattered. So, shepherd struck, sheep scattered, that's our headline today. Still though, did you notice the promise? As soon as Jesus has made his prediction, that comes in verse 28. So Jesus immediately says, verse 28, "But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Jesus is basically saying to them, once I've risen again, just like I've been saying that I will, meet me in Galilee. And he absolutely could have said to them, having said, "You'll all fall away, you'll all betray me," in verse 27, he definitely could have said, "And then once I've risen, then you'll be sorry, then you'll wish you never betrayed me." But what Jesus actually says is this. He says, "You'll all fall away and you'll all betray me. And then once I'm back, risen from the dead, I'll meet you in Galilee." So even after they've all betrayed him, Jesus is giving them a promise of reconciliation. These sheep are going to be scattered. They'll have deserted Jesus. But Jesus will get them unscattered. He'll meet them again in Galilee and they'll gather there once Jesus has risen again. So Jesus is showing them such mercy here. He's staying loyal to his disciples when he knows what they're about to do. He knows they're about to betray him. And then we read, didn't we, in verse 29, Peter insists he won't fall away, but Jesus knows what will really happen. He turns to Peter directly and says, verse 30, he says, "Peter, truly I tell you, today, yes, tonight, before the cock crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." The cock crowing was something that would happen consistently every single day, and it was pretty much the same time every day as well. In the previous chapter, chapter 13, Jesus listed the cock crowing amongst other times a day. He said, evening, midnight, when the cock crows, dawn. So Jesus is being really specific. He's actually saying a time of day. He knows what will happen in the next few hours, and he can give a really specific prediction to Peter. He says, today, yes, tonight, before the cock crows twice specifically, you will disown me three times. Johnny mentioned last week, didn't he, that every detail of what is about to happen to Jesus is all within his own hands. He doesn't just know what's happening, he's in control of it as well. He'll be delivered into the hands of sinners, to use Jesus' own words, but the situation itself is still going to be very much in Jesus' hands. He's in control. And then verse 31, all the other disciples insist they'll stay loyal to Jesus as well. They sort of back Peter up. Even if it means they'll die for it, they're convinced they won't fall away. And so we're left asking now as we read on, will anyone stay loyal to Jesus? Will anyone not desert him? And especially, what will Peter do? Because the text is really zoomed in on Peter in that first section. So we're left wondering, will anyone stay loyal to Jesus? Will anyone not desert him? And especially, what's Peter going to do? So let's read the next section of our story. And this second one I'm calling Falling Asleep in Gethsemane. It's verses 32 to 42. So from verse 32. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he told them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Once more he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough, the hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." So far, Jesus has said all his disciples would fall away. They'll all betray him. They'll be scattered. And then in this second section, we're going to start to see that happening, just in subtle ways at first, but we'll start to see it happening. There's a change of scene because now they go to Gethsemane in verse 32. Which was a garden. It's not far at all from the Mount of Olives where we left Jesus at the end of last week. Jesus wants to pray, so he leaves his disciples to sit whilst he does that, and then he goes a little bit further. Except, did you notice, he doesn't leave all of the disciples in quite the same place. He leaves most of them there, but then he takes Peter, James, and John a little bit further. And those three, Peter, James, and John, they were the three disciples that saw Jesus raised Jairus' daughter from the dead in chapter 5 when the other disciples were left outside the house. Those three went in and saw it. Those three were also the only ones to see Jesus transfigured in chapter 9 on a mountain when the other disciples were at the bottom of the mountain, left behind. So these three, Peter, James, and John, seem to be Jesus' very closest friends. And what those three closest friends see this time that the other disciples don't see, is Absolutely incredible. And I don't know about you, but I have read this before and not realized just how incredible it is. Because let me ask you a question. So far in Mark, how would you describe Jesus? So far in Mark, how would you describe Jesus? Because if you were going to describe about Jesus so far, you might talk about his authority. His authority to teach, to drive out demons, to control nature and even storms. You might mention Jesus's fearlessness when you describe him, because he hasn't shied away from confronting those corrupt religious leaders in the temple, the sinful practices going on there. He was fearless as well when he spoke up for those who were seen as the lowest in society, the children, or fearless when he commended a woman for pouring perfume on his feet when everyone else rebuked her. He stood up for her. Well, with those events in mind, how out of character does this seem to see Jesus as we do now? Verse 33, Jesus began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. Another translation says he began to be gripped by a shuddering terror. There are other translations that use words like horror or deep alarm or dismay. So all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere to us, there's this consuming and crushing, shuddering terror that grips Jesus, and it's unlike anything we've seen in Jesus so far. From that authoritative, fearless Jesus to this, verse 34 tells us he's so overwhelmed, the sorrow is so powerful, that he actually draws near to dying. Verse 35, he staggers to the stony ground and he prays. So what on earth has brought this on? What is it that's caused the change from the authoritative, fearless Jesus to this here? Well, we've seen what he prays, haven't we? And it's the same thing three times. He's asking for God the Father to take a cup away from him. The cup is from the Old Testament. It's a symbol of God's wrath, his judgment against sin. And it's a cup for God's enemies. It's theirs to drink because their sin against God deserves punishment. It's a cup for us to drink as enemies of God who've sinned against him. And it's enough to make Jesus stagger to the ground and draw close to death. So if we're asking, what on earth has brought on Jesus' sorrow, his crushing and overwhelming discomfort? Then the answer is, it's because Jesus is starting to look into this cup now that he's going to drink on our behalf. Jesus knows what's coming next. He keeps showing us that. He's been heading to the cross for a while now. And here in Gethsemane, he's beginning to come face to face with it. Jesus began our passage today by saying his disciples would all abandon him. They'd all be scattered. But on top of that, drinking this cup on behalf of sinners like you and me will mean that he takes God's wrath on himself. Not only the disciples will abandon Jesus, but God the Father will abandon Jesus too. I've got a quote from a book at this point. It's a really good book. It's called Living the Cross-Centered Life. I'd recommend it if you are the sort of person that reads, or not. It's short chapters. So not only the disciples are going to abandon Jesus, God the Father is going to abandon Jesus too. It says, "He who for all eternity has never been alone is now wholly abandoned. Such utter desolation has never even existed before in all eternity, because of the infinite love and fellowship of the Trinity, which can never be broken." Jesus has never been abandoned before. No one has ever been abandoned before like he was. And he's used to that perfect relationship with the Trinity. And now he's facing the cup of God's wrath. He's going to be abandoned by God. And there's another quote that I'll read as well. Bearing in mind that Jesus drank this cup, he took God's wrath on behalf of enemies of God, people like me and you. As we watch Jesus pray in agony in Gethsemane, He has every right to turn his tearful eyes towards you and me and shout, "This is your cup. You're responsible for this. It's your sin. You drink it." This cup should rightfully be thrust into my hand and yours. Instead, Jesus freely takes it himself, so that from the cross he can look down at you and me, whisper our names, and say, "I drain this cup for you. For you who have lived in defiance of me, who have hated me, who have opposed me, I drink it all for you." Jesus drinks from that cup instead of us on the cross, so that our sin can be dealt with and we can be in right relationship with God again. I need to mention, though, what I've just said is amazingly true if you're a Christian here today. Jesus drank that cup on your behalf at the cross, and you won't face God's wrath, even though you deserve to. If you're not a Christian here this morning, if you're not following Jesus, having turned from your sin to follow the King, like Johnny's been phrasing it, then you will face God's judgment one day, the thing that made Jesus himself stagger to the ground. You'll face that unless you turn to Jesus. Until you accept Jesus, you can't be in right relationship with God and free from the judgment that you deserve. So if that describes you at the moment, then please think about all this and maybe chat to someone who you came to church with, or with me, or with Glenn after the service, and we'd love to help you. Or there's also the church website. You can contact the church via there. So Jesus is face to face with the idea of drinking the cup on behalf of sinners like me and you. And amongst all this, what are the sinners doing? The disciples, the very people Jesus is about to die for, are already beginning to abandon him. Jesus says to him, to all of them, verse 34, "Stay here, keep watch." And then he returns to them, verse 37, and they're all fast asleep. In fact, even Peter is asleep with the others, which is significant because A, Peter was the most insistent that he wouldn't be falling away, even if everyone else did. And then B, Peter is one of Jesus' three closest friends, Peter, James, John. And after that, Jesus gives them the same instruction, verse 38. And again, they're asleep when he comes back in verse 40. Happens a third time in verse 41 as well. So the disciples who were so sure they would stick with Jesus in our first section, a few verses on, they're already showing signs of letting Jesus down. And it's not such a big jump now to say that we might see some scattered sheep quite soon. To top all this off, the section ends with the betrayer arriving. So let's read what happens next. It's verse 43 to 52. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Am I leading a rebellion," said Jesus, "that you've come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. This third section I'm calling Jesus is betrayed and the disciples fall away. So Jesus is betrayed, the disciples fall away. So Jesus has said, end of the last section, verse 42, "Here comes my betrayer," and then Judas turns up. Verse 43 calls him one of the 12. So it's happening just as it said, Jesus said it would last week. When he was talking about who would betray him, he said it's one of the 12. And now one of the 12 is here and he's betraying Jesus. Judas has got it all planned out. He greets Jesus, going, "Rabbi," and then kissing him. Two signs of genuine respect and friendship, if it weren't for what they meant this time around. Because Judas means it as a sign. This is Jesus, who you've been sent to take. And then the men arrest Jesus. In verse 47, a disciple cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant with his sword. And when you get to this point in the story in John's gospel, John tells us the disciple that cuts off the ear of the servant is Peter. So now Peter seems quite ready to stay loyal to Jesus. This seems great. And he's not gone about it in the best way, fair enough, but he seems to be ready to stay loyal to Jesus. So again, we're asking that question from earlier, aren't we? What will Peter do? Will Peter keep his promise? Because Peter's been a bit mixed so far, hasn't he? He's led the charge in insisting he really won't disown Jesus, and all the other disciples sort of rally behind him. But then he's fallen asleep, just like the other disciples did, just when Jesus needed their support. Now, though, he's ready to attack the high priest's servant if it means protecting Jesus. So that's great, isn't it? Peter's had a bit of a wobble earlier on, but he's come good, and Jesus will have Peter with him as he approaches his last hours. Sounds lovely, doesn't it? But then you get to verse 50, and it stops us right in our tracks. Verse 50 said, "Then everyone deserted him and fled." And then verse 51 to 52 as well, this mysterious naked man. There's a bit of debate about who it is, whether it could be Mark himself. But the point is, whoever it was, they were a follower of Jesus, it tells us. And yet they were so desperate to get away, they were willing to run naked if it meant they could escape. In verse 27, right at the start of our passage, Jesus told his disciples they would all fall away. And now verse 50, that's precisely what's happened. So we had, "You'll all fall away, and all the sheep will be scattered." Then in Gethsemane, they show signs of falling away by falling asleep when Jesus needed them most. Now Jesus has been outright betrayed by Judas, who has spent the last 3.5 years with Jesus, just like the other disciples. And the rest of them has fled too, even Peter himself, who had emphatically said, "Promise to stay with Jesus, whatever may come." So let's look at this next section, look at what happens next, Jesus' trial. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. Sorry, that's the previous section, isn't it? From verse 53. "They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against Jesus. 'We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, 'Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?' But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' 'I am,' said Jesus, 'and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven.' The high priest tore his clothes. 'Why do we need any more witnesses?' he asked. 'You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?' They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, 'Prophesy.' And all the guards took him and beat him." Jesus is taken to the authorities for his trial. We get more mixed messages from Peter because he's plucked up the courage now to follow Jesus, but it's just at a distance. And he's willing to sit by the fire with the guards that arrested Jesus. I've been working as a carer until recently, just visiting people in their homes. And sometimes you're doing a visit and it's just a social one. So you might go for a walk together, have a coffee and a chat, watch some TV. I promise there are parts of the job that deserve being paid as well. But one guy I used to see, He loved watching this show on TV. It's called Law and Order. I don't know if you've heard of it. It is quite boring, to be honest. But he wanted to watch it together, so we did, and we would sit and chat together as we watched it. So I don't know if you've seen it, but you've come across something like it, because there's so many versions of it. It's one of those lawyery courtroom dramas. Now we're watching, in this passage, a very early episode from 33 AD. And the trial begins in verse 55. It's false witness after false witness. And the thing is, verse 56, they're all lying, and yet none of them can agree with each other. There's nothing they can charge Jesus with. So Jesus is just doing brilliantly so far, and all he's had to do is just watch the shambles unfold. And then Jesus is asked a question. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? He's saying, are you God's Son, Jesus? And Jesus says, I am. And the rest of his answer says much the same thing. You think, oh, Jesus, what are you doing? It was all going so well because now the high priest has got something to charge you with. The high priest charges him with blasphemy. Jesus claimed to be God's Son, the Messiah. They had nothing to charge Jesus with at all until Jesus gave them something to charge them with. And of course, if you're here today and you're a Christian, then you'll say with me, Jesus didn't say anything untrue. He didn't commit blasphemy. It's not blasphemy if Jesus really was the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One. But because the high priest and his friends thought Jesus was lying, they called it blasphemy. And suddenly it's an open and shut case. Shortest episode of Law and Order ever, thank goodness. And Jesus' trial has ended with a guilty verdict. Verse 64, they all condemn Jesus as worthy of death. They spit at Jesus, blindfold him, strike him with their fists, and they mock him, prophesy. And ironically, they're doing exactly what he prophesied they would do. Chapter 10, verse 34, do you remember? He said he'd be handed over, mocked, spat at, flogged, and killed. In our passage, verse 27, the shepherd will be struck, Jesus said. Ultimately, Jesus the shepherd is struck on the cross very soon, but he's beginning to be struck now by the fists of the people telling him to prophesy. Last section now. Let's look at that last section, and we'll think about that, and then we'll think about what this means for us today. This last section, I'm just going to call Jesus Was Right, verse 66 to 72. While Peter was below, in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You also were with that Nazarene, Jesus, she said. But he denied it. I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said, and went into the entrance. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing round them, This fellow is one of them. Again he denied it. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, Surely you're one of them, for you are a Galilean. He began to call down curses, and he swore to them, I don't know this man that you're talking about. Immediately, the cock crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. Before the cock crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and wept. Well, we started our passage this afternoon with Jesus making his prediction to his disciples. He says, you'll all fall away. And it particularly zoomed in on Peter after Peter really insisted he would stay loyal to Jesus. And Jesus said, truly I tell you, Peter, you'll disown me three times. The camera pans away from Jesus, who's being mocked and struck, and we rejoin Peter by the fire amongst the guards. And amongst as well, a servant girl of the high priest, it would seem. She walks by, she's about to just go past, but then she notices Peter. She takes a good look at him and says, verse 67, you were with Jesus of Nazareth too, weren't you? And then Peter denies it. He pleads ignorance. I don't even understand what you're talking about, he says. Peter goes out into the entrance, and a servant girl sees him there too. She says to those around him, guys, this man was with Jesus. This man's one of them. And Peter denies it again. After a while, those around him seem to twig as well. Surely you're one of them. Surely you're with Jesus. Peter gets more agitated now, and he calls down curses and he swears to them, I don't know Jesus. The cock crows, reminding Peter of Jesus' prediction. Peter breaks down and weeps, presumably still in front of the guards and the servant girl. Peter was so sure he'd stand by Jesus, wasn't he? He went from cutting off the ear of a servant of the high priest in order to protect Jesus to meeting another servant of the high priest, this servant girl, and completely denying that he even knew Jesus. What will Peter do, we asked ourselves. Will everyone really fall away? Jesus said they would. Then the disciples three times fell asleep in Gethsemane, beginning to abandon Jesus when he needed their support. Judas outright betrayed Jesus. Verse 50, everyone deserted him and fled, even the man in verse 51 to 52 who fled naked to escape. And now Peter denies he even knew Jesus. And it's all happened just as Jesus said it would. Jesus knew his disciples would betray him, all of them. And Jesus still drank the cup for them, the cup of God's wrath on their behalf, the judgment for sin that was otherwise theirs to drink. This bit is so important. This bit's what the whole passage is shouting at us. Jesus died for those he knew would betray him. Jesus died for those he knew would betray him. As we start to think about what this means for us, let's think about who we might be in this story. So would we have been loyal to Jesus? Would we have stayed awake when he asked us to? Or would we have fled for our lives once the guards arrived? Would we have denied we even knew Jesus? When I was in secondary school, we went on a residential trip. I think it was year 7 camp. And a bit before we went away, we knew who we'd be in tents with. And a couple of boys that I'd soon share a tent with came up to me in the playground and said something along the lines of, oh, Ben, are you going to want to pray before your meals on camp? Because apparently you're a Christian. Like, are you going to do that? And this was a long time ago, but I've been really convicted by this memory as I've thought about this passage. Because what I said when I replied, I denied Jesus. I said to them something like, no, why would I do that? Like, you can't trust everything that starts with apparently, can you? I thought I was really smart. But I completely denied Jesus in what I said. So who are you in the story? Because I definitely know who I am. I'm someone who lets Jesus down, even though he died for me, even though he drank the cup for me. I wonder if you've got a memory a bit like my one. One where you outright denied Jesus. One where you let Jesus down another way, maybe, by not speaking up about being a Christian in the first place. Maybe trying to hide it from others because you're scared about what they might think or what they might say, how they might treat you. Or by telling your school or work friends you're a Christian, but then not acting like one, not representing Jesus in the way that a follower of him should. Maybe you're a Christian, but you join in with the inappropriate jokes that obviously don't glorify him, letting Jesus down. Maybe you're a Christian, but you let a moment pass by you where you had a brilliant chance to share the gospel with someone. Who are we in the story? We're the disciples. We're maybe even Peter, who let Jesus down, and we are much more like the disciples than we like to think. But there's a second answer to that question too. There's a second half of that sentence. We are the disciples that let Jesus down, and yet we're the disciples that let Jesus down that Jesus died for, that Jesus drank the cup of the wrath for. Jesus knew at the start of our passage he'd be let down by everyone. But that didn't change where he was going, did it? He still chose to let the guards arrest him. He still chose to tell the high priest who he was, knowing that would give him a guilty verdict. He still chose, and we'll read about it really soon in Mark, to go to the cross for us. There the shepherd would be very clearly struck, bearing the weight of our sin, tortured and killed like he was the very worst of criminals. To be a Christian, you don't have to complete a checklist of really holy tasks that you've ticked them all off. You don't have to earn God's love. If that were the case, Jesus' closest friends wouldn't have lived up to the task. We've seen that this afternoon. All of us deserve to drink the cup of God's wrath, not Jesus. And yet, knowing we would betray him, Jesus came to die for us anyway, dealing with our sin and making us right with God again. Jesus died for those he knew would betray him, people like me, people like you. So let's pray. Father, we all deserve to face your wrath as Jesus did. We have all let you down in countless ways. We're sorry for those times. We're sorry for being just like the disciples in today's passage. Please help us to follow you faithfully. Thank you so much that Jesus died for those he knew would betray him. People like the disciples, people just like us. Please change us day by day to make us more like you instead. Amen.